listening to Mom Band
all night long.
This is the sound of my soul.
The sound of my soul. It's Power Ballad Friday, of course, every Friday on the panel, albeit a softer Power Ballad this one. Spandau Ballet, of course, they became one of the more successful groups of their era of British pop. They were part of what was known as the Second British Invasion, selling millions of albums. Gary Kemp and Steve Norman first decided to form a band, both playing guitar in 1976 after witnessing the Sex Pistols perform in Islington. Well, I don't hear a lot of Sex Pistols in this, but this is you to a T, isn't it, Steve? You know, those new romantic nights at the Hacienda, you'd be there.
Can I make an absolutely shocking confession? I never actually went to the Hacienda. I grew up in Manchester. I never got there. But this is the soundtrack Amazing. To every sixth form college disco of my youth. Seriously, this is. I mean, I am back in Salford in the late 80s, and seriously, I'm having flashbacks.
I've just got to jump in here and just tell the nation, I've been, no other way to say it really, I have been love-bombed this afternoon. And I've been love-bombed by lovers of Eccles Cake. I have had pages and pages of Eccles. What are they? Who are they? I've never heard of them. Wallace, it's a delicious pastry. Sadly, most of the ones in a cafe are stodgy and not very nice. You may need to ask someone like Annabelle White to bake you some. Wallace, Eccles Cake from Canterbury Cheesemongers in Christchurch is to die for. Wanda and Mutta Mutta, Eccles Cakes, no sultanas, only currants, extraordinary. They just keep on going. Amazing. Who knew, Steve, Joe, Eccles Cake?
Hey, I knew.
I guess Steve did. He suggested it.
Yeah.
These are my people coming to my rescue. Yeah, Thank you, all of you.
They really are. Gosh. Eccles Cakes are fantastic. Eccles Cakes, you haven't lived until you've tried one. Wallace, I'm constantly surprised by you not hearing about one. Another one here. Eccles Cakes, they are the bomb. My sister makes them for Christmas every year. They do not last long. They are so much better than Christmas mince pies. Okay, so look, explain it just for a minute. What are they again? Why are they so good? Is it the flaky pastry? What is it?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, for me, obviously, there's the nostalgia factor, but it's kind of like a flaky pastry shell, disc. Like there's two layers, and you'll fill it with currants, maybe candied citrus peel, that kind of stuff, slight bit of spice. So you get a nice, and then you know, you glaze the top and the bottom with butter, bake them, and they will melt and they will fall apart in your mouth, and your mouth will thank you forever for it.
Absolutely delicious. And by the way, thank you so much for all your contributions this afternoon, your feedback. We always appreciate it. You can email me, thepanel at rnz.co.nz. You can text me as well, 2101. And this afternoon I am with Joe McCabe, a journalist at NZ Gardener, and Joe McCarroll, rather. Joe McCarroll and Steve McCabe, who is a lecturer at MIT. More than a third of Kiwis now rent, but only 5 of the country's members of parliament are registered as not having an interest in any real estate, according to the 2022 Register of Pecuniary Interests. Given how important the issue of rental prices and indeed New Zealand's declining home ownership, what should we make of this? With us is Dr. Lara Greaves, who's a political scientist from the University of Auckland. Dr. Greaves, kia ora. Oh, not yet. So Dr. Greaves isn't there. Actually, we're having a bit of a problem with our phone lines here. So we will come to Lara Greaves very, very shortly if we're able to. But let's pick up this with our panellists. I mean, the MPs are our representatives, Joe, but not quite as representative when it comes to one of the big issues facing New Zealand. What do you think about this issue?
Well, I mean, I think it didn't surprise me. That's not to say I think it's fantastic, but it's not unexpected, you know, because our elected representatives tend to be fairly established in their careers, which does mean they tend to be older. They are relatively well paid. And there's a generational divide. You know, I've got younger colleagues who just assume, you know, they'll never own a home. I guess, however, what I think is this is a symptom rather than the problem. I mean, if you, obviously this will never happen, but if you put a quota in place and said exactly a third of our elected representatives have to rent because that represents the people of New Zealand, that I don't think would fix anything much, because this is a symptom of inequality rather than the cause.
But it's one of the biggest issues. In fact, I think Dr. Greaves is with us now. Laura, kia ora. Welcome to the panel.
Kia ora.
Yeah, so we mentioned this particular issue here that, you know, a third of the Kiwis renting here, but you've got just five of our MPs registered as not having any interest in any real estate. What does research say about MPs mirroring the general population regarding race, disability, socioeconomics? What of this issue?
Yeah, there's so many different ways that we could talk about this or cut this or look at this. But basically there's this whole idea that within different types of representation that you want your parliament to represent the people in terms of certain things. And we often talk about that in terms of gender. We talk about ethnicity. One of the places that we really underrepresent is around disability and chronic conditions. But another one kind of relates to socioeconomic status. And we could think of that in terms of things like income, which is often controversial because MPs do have a solid income. And we can think about that in terms of assets. And that is why these asset registers are always something that we talk about every year. But I think this year has been particularly interesting in terms of that drop of the number of renting MPs.
Yeah, it's quite stark, isn't it? You've got 4% of MPs that were renters, 4%. There are, you know, people coming out. I think James Shaw did an opinion piece just the other day in the spin-off about this very issue. But do you think it could dampen efforts with regards to advocacy for those who rent?
I suspect that for renters, it's one of those things where everyone... you would hope that a lot of MPs would know renters and have people in their whānau that were renters. I don't think that necessarily, this is that thing that it comes back to where we do tend to look at these sort of how many houses in such and such as portfolio type things and go, oh, well, that might mean they're out of touch with the regular everyday people. And I think that generally the people who end up being our MPs tend to be from like social classes and backgrounds where they have that intergenerational wealth and access to things like house deposits. So I think that generally the renter thing, it's probably not as tricky to represent renters as it would be to represent people from different migrant backgrounds or disability groups and so on and so forth. But it's still something that is incredibly quite tricky because and we've had arguments in our various New Zealand politics classes actually around this, like whether that is a really crucial thing that we need to have a party representing, say, renters' rights.
Yes, yeah, more of a sort of a single issue or more of a sort of a honed focus of a particular party, right?
I have students that would argue that, like students from sort of that Gen Z generation, they would argue that that's one of those huge, big, kind of what you would call in the 90s or earlier, what we would call like those cleavages in New Zealand politics, you know, the urban-rural, religious, non-religious, that renter, homeowner could be one of those.
Steve?
Well, I mean, we're not going to say that they don't care about renters because they're not renters themselves and they're incapable of being empathetic. I think that would be a very broad statement to make. Instead, we could look at the fact that they are paying very little attention to the fact that renters don't really get looked after very well. The fact that, for example, rental properties are only required to have one heater in the entire house according to the tenancy standards means that nobody's really looking out for the interests of renters very much. And you start to wonder possibly if it's more an issue of conflict of interests. If there's an awful lot of people who are making these laws who realise that it could come back to bite them if they start putting requirements in for landlords, then sympathy for tenants might evaporate a little bit. You know, it's hard to it's hard to see beyond that, really, to be perfectly honest.
All right, stay there, Lara, and I'll just get Joe to come in, and you can respond.
Well, I mean, I think Lara's point about a party that reflects renters, I mean, that is maybe something that we should be looking. There's a political vacuum there that needs filling, because I just think we've got a generational change. We're looking to a future where people will rent for a lifetime. There are places in the world where that works. And we need to make it work for New Zealanders so they have safe homes.
Actually, Dr. Wilson, I just want to bring this up with you while you're here, if I may. A completely different topic. Te Pāti Māori says it won't stand a candidate in the upcoming Tauranga by-election because of the threats from white supremacists. And I just wanted what you make of this in terms of a political lens. This party decides not to stand because, you know, the Kohlis have been recipient of threats and hate speech by Tauranga residents. How do you see this?
Yeah, I think that fundamentally the Māori Party, in light of sort of their failings after pairing up with National, are really trying to represent a core group of Māori voters on the Māori roll, and so that's why Tauranga doesn't necessarily make sense as an electorate to stand in, because they're more focused on the Māori electorate seats. But putting that aside, I think that what they really are trying to do is to represent those who are Māori, who experience discrimination and marginalisation and are quite politically conscious about it. So I think that what they're doing at the moment is really trying to speak to that base and to really try to make sure that they show who the Māori Party is for the 2023 election and for this term, and that it's different from the previous Māori Party.
Yeah, very good. All right, thanks. Thanks as always, Dr. Lara Greaves there, political scientist from the University of Auckland. Nice to have you company this Friday afternoon. Well, you may want to sit down first if you decide to look at your KiwiSaver or Sharesies accounts or whatever. I decided to have a look at my KiwiSaver account an hour ago because of the story, and I hadn't looked at it for a few months. And I was actually quite shocked, to be honest with you. I closed it up straight away. $15.4 billion was wiped off the value of KiwiSaver funds in the first quarter of this year. Whoops, the phone is off there. And the saying, safe as houses, no longer applies to our property market. So you may be tempted to react, should you? If we can just get rid of that phone line there. It's just still going off the hook there. Hamish, could you just run in and good on you there. Do we have Francis on the line? Francis, are you there? No, not yet. What do you think? Are you there, Francis? No, we'll get her back. What do you think about this, Jo?
I mean, I think that is probably not unexpected. I mean, if you look at the markets over quite a long term, but a lot of people, including me really, have only really been in the markets in a time when we've been in an asset bubble that's, you know, practically like a hot air balloon that just felt like it would rise forever. But the long-term view is, you know, markets are volatile, but it is not about timing the market, it's time in the market. So you sit on your hands, yeah, you wait it out, and in the long run, you're in a better position for doing so.
Nonetheless, and in fact with us is Francis Cook, who is the investments editor at Newsdesk and creator of the Cooking the Books podcast. Francis, kia ora.
Kia ora. Business desk, in fact.
Oh, business desk. Sorry about that, Francis. My apologies. but look, you know, well done on the good work you're doing in this area. And I wanted to ask you, you might have heard me or might have not, that I took a quick look at, my KiwiSaver account just an hour before the show, and pretty stunned, actually, of how much has dropped. What of this? What of the panic?
Yeah.
How much worse is it going to get? I just want to know how much worse is it going to get.
Look, I don't want to lie to anyone. This year is probably not going to be great. I mean, I don't have a crystal ball, right?
Yeah, of course,
but
yeah.
It looks grim at the moment if you look at your KiwiSaver, and maybe potentially just don't look at it for the rest of this year.
We did see, and this is what Jo McCarroll was just saying, if you heard her, we did see a bounce back after the lockdown in 2020, and we can also recall that that wasn't a fluctuation. In fact, it was quite a deep dive, wasn't it? But it did surge back. Could we see a similar thing? I mean, what is going on in the world? Is it a different scenario?
Yeah, I mean, so basically the entire existence of KiwiSaver, we've had a stunning run. We've had it depends on whose definition you use, but a bull market is when things are all going really well. And by most people's definition, we've had really good bull market for the last 13 years, which is the longest in history.
Right.
So we've all gotten really cozy just watching things go up. And probably from now, we're going to get a bit more of your normal ups and downs and all of that sort of stuff. Now, the thing is, it doesn't feel nice to look at it. But when things go down, that's actually part of how you make money in the long run. That's why if you have a growth or aggressive KiwiSaver, they go up and down a lot more. Because even though those downs feel horrible, they are part of how you make money, because it's not just that your balance has gone down, it's that everything is cheaper. So you put in the same amount of money, you buy things cheaper, and then in a few years' time, hopefully everything bounces back and you make more money. It just doesn't feel great, but it's important to know that the head and the heart on this one, not aligned.
Okay, all right. Steve McCabe.
Well, I struggle with having too much sympathy in cases like this. I mean, basically what we're saying is that when you wake up in the morning, the unearned wealth that you're simply accumulating without doing anything to earn isn't quite as wealthy as it was. We've got something similar going on with income, with people who are struggling to make ends meet. They've seen their income effectively go down in terms of its buying power, but we're not having quite the same existential angst about that.
This is people's lives as well, Steve. These are people who, you know, might be retiring very soon, and their savings, which they've saved for years, are plummeting, and you don't have an ounce of concern.
I didn't say that. What I would suggest is, do they stand to withdraw more money than they took out?
Francis?
Because if they don't, then they haven't lost money. They just simply haven't made as much without doing anything to earn it. That's the difference. So it's not that I don't have sympathy for them. I just don't have as much sympathy as I do for people who are seeing that their earned income is worth less because of the cost of living crisis.
All right, got your point. Actually, I do want to ask Francis, back to that notion of actually not actually looking at it. Is it actually a move to say, on this particular issue, it's probably, and if you do have savings, and many people do have savings, whether it be in some sort of investments, is it wise to just keep your head in the sand on this one?
Yeah, I mean, I think for something like your retirement accounts, your KiwiSavers, you're usually thinking long term, right? So what's more important is deciding on the best strategy for you and ignoring the news usually on a day-to-day basis. I mean, this is all sort of general tips, so everyone's individual situations can be different. But if you are retiring or hoping to buy a house in under 5 years, then usually something like a conservative account is a better idea. Those will not have gone down as much. They have gone down a bit because inflation and all that, even cash in the bank is worth less than it was. But, you know, they move a little bit less. And if you've got yonks to go, if it's 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, then for most people, a growth account does better. And you just decide on your settings, you push it there, and then you try your best to ignore it. Just make sure it's set up the way you want it to be. And then when it comes to dips like this, just have faith in your long-term plan.
Good advice, Francis. Well, not advice, but good sentiments there. Kia ora, thank you very much for your time. That is Francis Cook, the creator of Cooking the Books podcast. So in this particular case, the notion of head in sand is perhaps one avenue to follow. It is 7 to 5, the panel, RNZ National Friday. Rugby's biggest tournament is finally heading to the US, the Rugby World Cup. We staged in the United States for the first time after being voted on Thursday, Friday, New Zealand time, as the host of the men's event. That's 2031, we way out, and the women's tournament in 2033. Rugby's first major attempt to unlock what they see as untapped potential, placing rugby into the wider American sporting consciousness. Now, last month, President Joe Biden gave a government backing for, quote-unquote, the development of rugby in the United States. With us to discuss is sports journalist Hamish Bidwell. Kia ora, Hamish.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. So, rugby has been played in a stadium, say, downtown Dallas. Will people care?
A little rugby will care because they're going to make some money, and that's the start and finish of the whole argument, really. They won't do anything for rugby per se. It's not going to take America by storm.
Right.
We're not going to see a huge increase in playing numbers. The American Eagles aren't suddenly going to become a force on the world playing stage. It'll just be a revenue-generating exercise, a bit like FIFA going to Qatar for this year's World Cup.
Actually, the piece I was reading by Steve Douglas saying, look, now comes the hard part for the sports leadership, generating enough interest and sustainability to secure rugby's place in a crowded US market. I'm thinking, gosh, this is when the time of the NFL will be on, the start of the NBA. What do you think the chances are of rugby securing a good footing?
Nil. They'll get lots of travelling fans. There may be some expats. But one of the differences here, the most recent World Cup, Rugby World Cup, was in Japan. Now, they have a really well-established and extremely popular university competition, which actually attracts more viewers and spectators than their professional rugby does. But again, they have a long-established history of professional rugby, which is well-patronised, not as well as the university, but still well-patronised. None of those things exist in the United States. And this idea that at a time of year where eyeballs are elsewhere, they're suddenly going to be diverted to rugby, I find fanciful.
Right. Joan McCarroll.
Yeah, I would have to say, I feel like I've been hearing that, you know, rugby's going to take off in America for my natural life, and I'm not young. I guess my question for Hamish would be, if it's going to be on the scale that it is now, New Zealand will never host again? I mean, will countries like, real rugby countries like Ireland and Scotland and Wales, I mean, will they have the infrastructure to ever host a World Cup?
Not as a sole host, no. I mean, you think about Wales and Scotland, they can host as part of a broader package of a British Isles type scenario. New Zealand, as it stands, could host it, but it wouldn't make the revenue that World Rugby seeks. So, despite the fact that it would be successful here as it has been in the past, and the stadiums would be full, and we do have a rugby public, it won't come because it won't generate the dough.
Steve?
Well, I mean, when I was living in the US, and I was there for 8 years, and I never really saw much rugby being shown on TV, being talked about. I mean, Americans, globally speaking, like their minority sports. They like the sports that they play and nobody else plays because they don't really like the competition from the rest of the world. Rugby's just not an American thing. They've already got a sport that they think is a little bit like rugby. Obviously, it's not. But I don't see that there's room in America for rugby. They don't want it. Maybe we should do something like what Eurovision does. And the winner each year gets to host the next time. I should keep it in New Zealand.
And I should say here, Wallace, I don't want to be too dismissive of the American public. The New Zealand public aren't that interested in rugby at the moment either. It's a hell of a pedantic, pedestrian game, littered with stoppages. Like, viewership and spectator numbers there are really poor.
Really?
Yeah, the powers that be, whether they be at the host broadcaster Sky or whether they be at New Zealand Rugby, are really scratching their heads about what they can do to speed the game up, make it more spectator-friendly. It's actually really struggling, and so if they do want it to succeed in America, if they do want people to go, then they have to have a serious look at rugby's laws to make it a game that people can understand. The whistle blows and no one knows why. Like, it has to be something that you can watch and get a feel for, get the rules.
Yeah.
Otherwise, as it stands at the moment, it's utterly perplexing.
Always good to have you on, Hamish. Kia ora, thank you for that. That's Hamish Bidwell there, sports journalist, and wonderful program. Again, just sorry about some of the phone lines and phone cutouts. We hope to get guests back into the studio for the panel sometime in the next few weeks. We promise you on that. Someone says here, fellow Northerner, Steve McCabe, do you miss your spotted dick?
I beg your pardon?
I'm just spotted assuming...
dick's not really a Northern... Spotted dick's not really a northern thing, to be honest. I mean, I miss my white pudding. Something rotten. You can't get a decent one here.
What is it? What is a spotted dick?
It's basically, it's a, ooh, how should we say, a steamed pudding with black currants and the like in it.
All right. Anyway, very good, Steve. Joe, thank you very much. You've been wonderful. And why don't we take you away to the weekend on a little bit of a power ballad. This is, again, Spandau Ballet. Thanks to my producers, Charlie Dreamer, and I'm Wallace Chapman, Lisa Owen with Checkpoint next. See you Monday, 3:45.